Welcome to episode 168 of NIH Research Radio. NIH Research Radio, bringing you news and information about the ongoing medical research at the National Institutes of Health, NIH, turning discovery into health. I'm your host, Joe Belimpi, and coming up in this episode, two awareness campaigns for September, one about pulmonary fibrosis and the other on cholesterol.
It's important to look at your saturated fat intake, your fiber intake, maintain a healthy weight, or if you are overweight, try and lose weight and be physically active daily.
Also, the first of a new partnership between NIH Radio and the NCI Cancer Bulletin. We'll learn about a biobank program. But first, this news update. Here's Craig Fritz.
NIH has announced that six projects have been awarded to fund development of robots that can interact and work cooperatively with people and respond to changing environments in a variety of healthcare applications. The awardees for the National Robotics Initiative will work on projects that would accelerate the development of the next generation of robotics called co-robotics. These projects include robots that help engineers design better prosthetic legs for amputees, miniature robot pills that help doctors diagnose and treat disease, and even micro-robots that help researchers make artificial tissues. NIH Director Dr. Francis Collins said robots that can adapt to new situations and support the work and activities that people do on a daily basis are not just the future of robotics, they're already here. This work could result in more successful surgeries, better and faster recovery for stroke patients, and improvements in drug development and testing. Affordable, accessible robotic technology can facilitate wellness and personalized home-based healthcare, especially for the growing elderly and disabled population. NIH is funding the project along with the National Science Foundation, NASA, and the United States Department of Agriculture. For this NIH News Update, I'm Craig Fritz.
News updates are compiled from information at www.nih.gov/news. Coming up, insight into your lungs and arteries and a story of biobanks on NIH Research Radio. September is Pulmonary Fibrosis Awareness Month. To learn more, I asked Dr. James Kiley here at the NIH what is important for people to know about this lung disease.
The important things for the public to know about pulmonary fibrosis is that it is a serious lung disease in which the tissues deep in the lung become thick, they become scarred, they become stiff, and over time they prevent cause difficulty with breathing. That scarred tissue is what's called fibrosis. So when you have pulmonary fibrosis, you have lung impairment due to scarring of the lung tissue, which makes it very difficult to breathe, and it then becomes a very debilitating disease.
What does it mean that most cases of pulmonary fibrosis are referred to as idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis?
Well, idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis is means that at the present time we cannot find a cause for pulmonary fibrosis. We don't know the inciting agents responsible for pulmonary fibrosis, and we don't know exactly all of the pathology, pathobiology, the mechanisms that underlying why some individuals are exposed to certain agents and get this pulmonary scarring that leads to pulmonary fibrosis and why some don't. So the whole idea of how do we identify people early is a critical element in this disease, because oftentimes it's very slow, it's its onset, and as such, many individuals don't recognize that they have something going on in their lungs. And when they do, if it is pulmonary fibrosis, the prognosis is relatively poor.
Dr. Kiley, what are some of the signs and symptoms? How does someone know if they have it?
Sure. With many of the lung diseases, you will often experience a shortness of breath, difficulty breathing. You may be fatigued. You may have some aching muscles. You may actually have some unintended weight loss that you don't really can't explain. There's also in pulmonary fibrosis a very obvious clubbing that occurs in the fingers, which means they become somewhat enlarged and rounded at the tips. And that may also be an indication that something's going on that's maybe related to the lung condition. There's sometimes a very dry cough that goes on. And so these are some of the signs and symptoms. The biggest of all are the shortness of breath, the difficulty breathing, doing just normal activities. And that's one that you would want to be certainly aware of and discuss with your physician.
Is pulmonary fibrosis common? Do you know who and how many people are affected, Dr. Kiley?
Pulmonary fibrosis is actually classified as a rare condition. And we have estimates based on the published literature that it affects approximately 150,000 persons in the United States, and that there's an incidence of about 20,000 to 50,000 new cases per year. But still, it may be an underdiagnosed disease. And what's important about pulmonary fibrosis, September being Pulmonary Fibrosis Month, is that this is an attempt to raise awareness about a very serious and important lung condition. It oftentimes affects older people, but not necessarily only older people, and that we know that there are some risk factors associated with pulmonary fibrosis that people, if they can take account of those, would maybe be able to diagnose or get some attention to the disease much earlier than usual.
What are some of those risk factors?
Well, we know that some of the things that cause pulmonary fibrosis are various environmental pollutants, some of the inorganic dust like hard metal dust and silica, even some of the organic dust like animal proteins and bacteria may also have a role in pulmonary in initiation or inciting as an exciting agent for pulmonary fibrosis. Also, more recently, we've learned that chronic herpes virus infections seem to be associated with this disease. Certainly, tobacco smoke and cigarette smoking has been associated with pulmonary fibrosis. And interestingly enough, some individuals have gastroesophageal reflux, which is also something that seems to be more common in the pulmonary fibrosis patient population. These are all potential risk factors that may be associated with the disease.
And again, you say this is a serious disease.
Yes, that's the sad part about this disease, that what we've learned is that that once the diagnosis is made, that that the disease progresses relatively rapidly, and as such, we know that the mortality is very high 3 to 5 years out post diagnosis.
If somebody has IPF or pulmonary fibrosis, is there something they can do to manage the disease?
There are a number of things that can be done, and if pulmonary fibrosis is severe enough, then supplemental oxygen may be helpful. There are therapies to manage the patient's symptoms, some of which could be diuretics to deal with reduced leg swelling. Sometimes pulmonary rehabilitation can be helpful. And your doctor can identify some approaches that may be useful. In the very end, if some of these medical behavioral interventions don't work or are not as successful and the patient continues to deteriorate, either single or double lung transplant could be available for selected individuals with pulmonary fibrosis without certain comorbidities that may complicate that procedure.
Is the NIH currently supporting any IPF-related research or clinical trials?
Yes, we have a very active and robust research program in pulmonary fibrosis, and it's certainly a priority area for the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. Many IPF projects are covering some very basic science, translational research, some clinical research. The NHLBI supports a clinical research network called the IPF Network. Right now, it's sponsoring two clinical trials, one of them looking at current ways to manage IPF through pharmacotherapy, another looking at carbon monoxide as a treatment for IPF. So there are a number of trials going on that are addressing the problem. We also know that the pharmaceutical industry is very interested in this disease, and they're conducting a couple of trials of some very novel agents that may be prospects for the future. So we're optimistic that maybe down the road there may be some interventions, some new agents that might be available for patients with pulmonary fibrosis.
Thank you, Dr. Kiley. Before we finish, is there anything you would want to reemphasize for Pulmonary Fibrosis Month?
I think that the important thing that we want to reemphasize in this whole awareness month effort is that it is a serious lung condition. It's one that gradually develops, and it's one that is has a poor prognosis, and that's sad, and it's not good. And so we're very actively engaged in research to try to look for new therapies and look for ways to best manage this disease and try to do better with reducing the mortality and suffering related to it.
Again, that's Dr. James Kiley at the NIH's National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. For more information on IPF and pulmonary fibrosis, visit www.nhlbi.nih.gov. September is also National Cholesterol Education Month. Experts say it's a good time to get your blood cholesterol checked. And why?
High cholesterol is a major risk factor for heart disease, which is the number one killer of Americans.
That's NIH nutritionist Janet DeJesus. I asked her, what exactly is high cholesterol?
Just to back up a bit, cholesterol is a waxy, like fatty type substance that's in your body. It circulates through the body naturally, but if there's too much of it, it can cause problems. And basically, it builds up as plaque in your arteries, and it causes hardening of the arteries, which is called atherosclerosis if it's in the coronary arteries. And this leads to coronary artery disease, which is the major type of heart disease.
And can people feel cholesterol as it builds up?
Absolutely not. Not until you might feel angina or chest pain, which can happen after there's quite a bit of buildup. And the cholesterol or plaque buildup actually starts in children. You know, we have a lot of evidence on that. So it's important to start early with these behaviors that we'll talk about.
Okay, so what behaviors or lifestyle changes can people take to treat high blood cholesterol?
So there's two main portions, nutrition and physical activity, and we call it the therapeutic lifestyle changes. And the main portion of nutrition is to lower your saturated fat intake. So this type of fat is the solid fat. So it's in high-fat dairy, high-fat beefs and meats. It's on the skin of poultry, those types of things. And also, it's important to maintain a healthy weight. So losing weight will actually help you lower your cholesterol. And there's a couple of other items. There's now a additive in foods called stanols and sterols. So this is naturally in plants, but they found that it lowers LDL cholesterol. So if you do have high cholesterol, you can buy these products. They're putting it in butters, salad dressings, even some like orange juice. So, but it's better to prevent. If you can prevent, you know, keep a healthy weight, have a low intake of saturated fat. Another point is physical activity can definitely help, you know, keep your numbers low.
You mentioned the TLC or Therapeutic Lifestyle Changes programs. Can you explain more about how that program can help adults lower their cholesterol?
Sure. You usually start off with the nutrition part. So lowering your saturated fat intake, increasing your dietary fiber, which I didn't mention before. It's important to start slowly, like take one step at a time, because there's a lot of features. You know, there's the saturated fat, the fiber intake, the healthy weight, the physical activity. So it's really important to start slowly and pick one of the items. Kind of look at what you're eating. If you don't know, you know, what of your foods are high in saturated fat, you can work with a registered dietitian or even start reading the food labels. So it's really, it could take, you know, up to 3 months. So you really have to give it a chance to work and then get your cholesterol rechecked by your doctor.
So people can use TLC both as treatment or prevention.
Absolutely.
Either way, you want to get things measured first.
Definitely. I mean, we encourage everyone to practice these behaviors, not just those with high cholesterol. So it's easier to prevent than to treat. So we definitely encourage people to prevent before this happens. Know your numbers.
How can people get their numbers? How is blood cholesterol measured?
It's measured by a blood test. So the best type is a fasting lipid panel, which has to be done in your doctor's office. They do, you can go to screenings, you know, they have them at the mall, they're non-fasting, and those will give you some results, but not the all of the details. So it could give you some high-level results that may cause you to go to your doctor and get your fasting lipid panel measured.
NIH nutritionist Janet De Jesus, anything about National Cholesterol Education Month you would want to mention or reemphasize?
Just one thing to mention, there's different things that affect your cholesterol level. So, for example, your hereditary. So some people, it's in your genes, unfortunately. So there's something called familial hypercholesterolemia, where, for example, if your dad had it and perhaps it's genetic, you may have a harder time. It doesn't mean that you have to live with high cholesterol, but it's just something to be aware of, especially in children. They're now watching out for that. Age and gender affects blood cholesterol, so it starts rising naturally at age 20. So that's when they encourage, you know, if you haven't had it measured, definitely get it measured. So those are the things you really can't change, but then the things you can change, you know, we talked about the lifestyle behaviors.
Thank you very much, Janet De Jesus at the NIH's National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. For more information about cholesterol and the TLC program, visit the website www.nhlbi.nih.gov. Coming up, how researchers are not just banking tissue samples, but creating a system to preserve and learn from our genes. That's next on NIH Research Radio.
Dr. Gaines, nice to see you getting groceries instead of in your office.
Hi, Julia. How are the kids?
Great. They're at a birthday party.
I have to put on my pediatrician's hat here. I haven't seen them in my office for flu vaccines yet.
They're big kids. Do they need flu vaccines?
CDC recommends flu vaccinations for all kids from 6 months through 18 years. Flu can be serious.
I'll get the kids their flu vaccines, Doc.
And you can get your flu shot right here. I'll even treat you to a lollipop.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Welcome back to NIH Research Radio. In this episode, we're starting a new reoccurring segment in partnership with the NCI Cancer Bulletin, a publication of the NIH's National Cancer Institute. Writers from the Bulletin will talk about the stories they are covering. Our first writer is Ted Winstead. Welcome to NIH Research Radio. Ted, can you first explain a little about the NCI Cancer Bulletin?
The NCI Cancer Bulletin is an online newsletter that provides timely information about cancer research. Our readers include scientists, doctors, nurses, cancer patients, family members, advocates, and the interested public.
The most recent issue is from September 18th. What was the story you had in that issue?
One of the stories we had was about a project known as GTEx, which is about collecting normal tissue that can then be used to try to better understand how the body works.
What does GTEx stand for?
GTEx stands for Genotype Tissue Expression Project.
Basically, what's the project doing?
The project is collecting multiple samples, little tiny pieces of tissue from people who have died and donated their bodies to research. And part of what's unique here is that they are collecting from up to 30 different kinds of tissue from the body, from heart, muscle, skin, spleen, to try to understand how genes are regulated in each of these different tissues.
So it's more than just banking the tissues, right?
That's right. Part of it is to develop a bank of tissues that researchers can use in the future, and it's also to try to learn how genetic variation from little differences in our DNA from one person to the next, how that may affect how genes are turned on and off in different tissues.
There's also a collection process. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Yes, the collection process was overseen by the Cancer Human Biobank, or CA Hub, and they developed a whole new process, a whole new way for collecting all of these tissues. As soon as tissue is removed from the body, it begins to change. And researchers like to know a study tissue that's as close to how it is in the body as possible. And this project put into place more than 150 different standard operating procedures to try to make sure that the tissue changes as little as possible when it's removed from the body.
We in the government love standard operating procedures.
Sure.
It's also important for science for that standard, right, from measuring one sample to the next.
That's correct. And right now, there are many, many questions about what are the best ways to go about collecting and preserving and storing these tissues. And many of the researchers on this project believe that the lessons learned and the procedures used in this study will guide future efforts to collect, process, and store these tissues that are so important for scientific research.
While you were working on the story, were there some things that struck you about it?
Yes, there were. I was struck by the basic approach, which was the investigators wanted to leave nothing to chance, and they wanted to document everything they could in order to help biobankers going forward and researchers who use the tissues. So one example is in the kits that were developed to ship the tissue from where it was collected to the biobanks, there are data loggers inside these kits that record the temperature every minute. And this could help researchers learn what are the best temperatures for shipping specimens. And that question has never been asked before in a systematic way or on such a large scale.
What were some of the things that the people you talked to said about the system and the whole topic?
Everyone was enthusiastic. They said, this has never been done, and we are really excited to see what the results are. The idea of being able to understand how inherited changes in our DNA have an impact on how genes are turned on and off would have many implications for researchers trying to understand both health and then disease as well.
Is there a question that I didn't ask that you think I should have, or maybe something that you would want to reemphasize about your article?
Many of the people I talked to said that without the donors and without their families, this would not be possible. Another aspect of the study is to also learn the best way to tell donors and donor families about the project and make sure that their consent is given. And that's another important area where researchers are still trying to learn the best ways to proceed.
I understand you're working on another story for this. You've done another story for this issue. Can you mention that one quickly as well?
Yes, there have been 5 studies in the past 2 weeks describing the genetic landscape of lung tumors. This is being done on a larger scale than ever before, and the Cancer Genome Atlas Project is taking a lead, was the lead on one of these. And the good news is that all of the researchers found changes to genes or what they call pathways that could potentially be targeted by drugs, many of which exist right now.
Thank you very much, Ted Winstead of the NCI Cancer Bulletin. For more on Ted's stories, visit the website www.cancer.gov/NCI Cancer Bulletin. There is also a video available there as well. And for more on the GTEx program, visit the website commonfund.nih.gov/GTEx. We'll have more from Bulletin writers and editors in future episodes of NIH Research Radio. For now, that's it for this episode. Please join us again on Friday, October 5th, when our next edition will be available. If you have any questions or comments about this program or have a story suggestion for a future episode, please let me know. Send an email to nihradio@mail.nih.gov. Also, please consider following NIH Radio via Twitter @NIH Radio or on Facebook. Until next time, I'm your host, Joe Belinfi. Thanks for listening.
NIH Research Radio is a presentation of the NIH Radio News Service, part of the News Media Branch, Office of Communications and Public Liaison, and the Office of the Director at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, an agency of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.